Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Cloak and Dagger podcast. You are listening to your host, Will Davis Coleman, and I am joined by my co-host,
Patrick Courtney, your dear friend.
Hi, Patch. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you? I'm very excited we're starting this. This is great fun.
I know. It's so exciting that we're finally here and ready to go.
Yeah, we've talked about this doing this for a while now.
We have indeed. We have indeed. So, Patrick, why are we on the airwaves today then?
So, you and I have been friends for quite a number of years now. We met at uni, at Manchester Uni, and you were doing history at the time. And as far as I can remember, we spent most of our time talking about what you were learning on your course. We rarely talk about what I learned on my course because it was less interesting. But all the history stuff you learned, I remember like hours we'd just talk about something to do with the Middle Ages or Templars or whatever you were learning back then. And we've kind of just kept doing that for as many years as I've known you. We just like talking about history. So we thought it would be a great idea to turn this into a podcast. And
so that like strangers can listen to our conversations. Yeah. That yeah. Self-important.
We think our conversations are that good that we thought other people might enjoy it. Or it's just other people who like talking about history. I think a lot of our friends didn't like, you know, or our girlfriends got a bit bored of us talking about history so much. So this way, people can choose to listen to us if they want to.
Yeah, I like that. I like how you've put it. That's exactly true. as our title suggests, we won't just be focusing on any history. We'll actually be focusing on assassinations through history.
Yes.
Now, we don't just like assassinations in history as per se, but we also are pretty big fans of the Assassin's Creed game as well.
Yeah, where we kind of got the idea for this. And actually, what we liked about the game so much, which is kind of dropped off a bit over time, it's been the real history, like the fact that they really did dive into history. And although it is kind of a fantasy world of, and a version of it, the history of those games is really cool and really like inspired us. I mean, the games came out when we were quite young, I imagine. It certainly did push me towards liking history more when I was younger. And so we thought we can look into some really interesting assassinations through time and across the world, because there's some really crazy, weird ones that I feel like a lot of them don't get any
press.
Yeah, that's one way to put them. Or you don't learn about them in school too much, maybe because they're a bit, you know, a bit morbid. So we're going to do a 6-episode mini-series starting today, and we'll be jumping back and forth between us, who's sort of leading the episode and who will be telling the other one about the cool assassination they've found out about.
Yeah, and so the very first one today will be with me leading, and it will be on the Assassin's Creed original game and the history behind the Masyaf assassins. Also, you can find us on Instagram at Cloak and Dagger Podcast, where we will share updates and images relating to each weekly episode, so check it out.
Yeah, there's some really cool visual stuff that we talk about in some of the episodes, and it's great to be able to see a bit more. See maps, yeah, or see paintings or see images of the time. It really helps you bring you in.
And even a few of the murders as well. So, yeah, sorry, assassinations. Yeah.
So, welcome to the Cloak and Dagger podcast.
Okay, so Today we will be talking about, they were known as the Nizari Ishmali sect, or also known as the Assassins to us. Also known as the Hashashin as well. Depending on who you're talking to. And we'll come to that later, why they're called that, as we go along. But essentially, we're talking... This sect was a very successful cult, for want of a better word. And to make it even more brutal, that they were a death cult, really, because they would obviously commit assassinations on behalf of their leader. So it's kind of a pretty...
More than most cults are death cults, this is a particularly high death rate cult.
Yeah, exactly. A very successful one as well. So just to put it in perspective, where we're talking about is modern day Israel, Egypt, Palestine, Gaza, and Syria. That's kind of encapsulates most of where we're talking about. And we're going back at almost 1,000 years to around 1140 through to about 1270. So that's kind of the period of time. Those 130 years were sort of the sort of golden age of this of the assassins.
Peak crusade time as well.
Exactly. Well said, Patrick. So the game, the Assassin's Creed, the first game, if I'm sure many of our listeners have played it, is set during the Third Crusade in 1191. So that's kind of like 50 years into the Golden Age. So you're really hitting your stride if you're an assassin in this time period. Now, these guys, they were quite indiscriminate with who they killed. As long it was more down to the threat that they posed to the actual assassins themselves. So they would kill Sunni, they would kill Shiite, and they would kill Crusaders as well. So they didn't take
sides. As opposed to just, you know, Islamic warriors defending Islam, they were defending themselves and their group and their fortresses and their people.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, long before the Crusaders even turned up, they were already active in this area, especially in Syria. So they actually started out as a hill tribe.
Right.
And they then managed to expand. Their favourite places, a bit like in the game, which is where the assassins live in the game, is called Masyaf. And that actually does exist and still exists today. And it was owned by them. But this is just one of maybe as many as 70 hilltop fortresses which they owned, which kind of spanned thousands of miles from sort of southern Syria all the way through down to Jerusalem. They had all sorts of strongholds, which made them a really difficult sect to actually control, because they were all the way up in the hills. They had very good support from their locals, and so no one wanted to give them up. And it's very difficult to take them out because they were very good at what they did.
And they're not really, it's not like a state. They're not really a country. They are just these collection of fortresses. They're not really, you know, they haven't become an entire country on their own.
No, I don't think we could ever say they actually formed a state of any sort, but they all followed the same tenets of the Assassin's Creed order, if you like.
Which aren't actually the same as what are in the games, because
they're
a bit more insane and a bit harder to be the protagonists in a game if you listen to them.
Yeah, exactly. But let's focus straight into the sort of the history within the game. So let's start with Masyaf the place. So Masyaf was taken by away from the local Mamluk warlord who was controlling it for the empire of the Ayyubids, who were, if you've ever heard of Saladin, that was the Ayyubid tribe that were controlling that part of the world at the time. So they ambushed and killed the commander of the fortress, a man named Munkid. And then they took the fortress, and this was in 1140. So that's kind of the advent of this sect in the area, and the beginning of our story, because Masyaf became a sort of capital of all of the hill fortresses.
Right. So they were kind of in and around before then, but then their taking of Masyaf was a big first step to being this terrifying death cult.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so Masyaf was a very strong fortress, and you can see it, and we'll put it up on our Instagram page as well, what it would have looked like and what it looks like today, with a little bit of Assassin's Creed concept art in there too.
Yeah.
But they controlled the local villages as well, which meant that they always had a steady flow of food and resources, and also novices that they could induct into their cult. I shouldn't call it cult, into the Assassin's Creed. I'm just going to call it the Assassin's Creed.
It's okay, easier. Okay. It's kind of a cult. I mean...
I know, but I feel bad because cults kind of get a bad name. I guess they probably deserve their bad name.
Yeah, I also don't think... I'm assuming that they're not really around anymore. If you believe the games, they are, but...
No, they are. The Nizari Ismaili sect still exists, but they don't kill people anymore.
Well, this has put a dark turn on this podcast. I'm now slightly worried about what we're going to say.
No, the Aga Khan is the head of their sect, and the Aga Khan is a very famous man, and he's a religious man.
Wow. I'm all for them there. Yeah, I agree. Not cult, just great people.
So they controlled Masyaf from 1140 through to 1270. So they were there a long time, and they couldn't get moved. And when you think of how big these forces were during the crusading period, they still couldn't extricate them. So they were really tricky to get rid of, if you like. But let's just if we just move on to sort of what they believed in. This is what was so clever about how they were set up. They believed entirely in the idea that their master was God's anointed and Muhammad's anointed representative on earth.
Like their Pope.
Yeah, like their Pope. And if the Pope, I don't know much about the Pope ordering killings, but if the Pope ordered you to kill someone, and you would do it, otherwise you
could. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would be, you don't want to say no to the Pope.
That's so kind of your journey into heaven, from a Catholic point of view, of doing what the Pope asks.
Yeah. So there was a very strong belief at the core of this cult that they would believe in their master. And their master during the games is called Al-Mu'allim, which I'm sure many of you remember. Mm-hmm. But Al-Mu'allim actually means teacher in Arabic. So it's actually not a name. It's actually just a sort of, it's like saying teacher. But the man himself was a man known as Rashid ad-Din Sinan, which I've probably just butchered. Sorry about that. But he was also known as the Old Man of the Mountain by the Franks. So all the Crusaders would know them as Old Man of the Mountain. And the reason was that all the hill forts were in the mountains. So he was sort of, you know,
the old man, ruler of all those crazy death cultists. I mean, great religious people in the mountains. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they were really pretty powerful in their belief, because it wasn't just that they believed that their master would tell them what to do and they'd go and do it. In the initiation period, that's where everything lies in terms of their beliefs. So what would happen is, if you were a young novice, they'd normally take them at around 14 or 15 years old, from what we know, and they were always men, and they would be taken to a fortress like Masyaf. And they would be conducted through various trials to see if they were worthy enough to join. And it's quite hard to know how much is to be believed, but the source on this is actually Marco Polo himself, which is quite interesting. Yeah, but Marco Polo did make a few things up. I mean, if you're the only one traveling the entire world at the time, who's going to verify?
Kind of got a monopoly on all the stories, yeah.
Yeah, but the most interesting part of that, though, is that where they get the name Hashashin, and it's where we get the word hashish these days, and assassin, is that within the initiation, they would be shown, and I put shown in quotation marks, they were shown heaven.
Right.
So part of the belief system, as I said, was that the Pope, they were like, they had their own Pope who would tell them what to do. And he would essentially be drugged, these novices, would be drugged and taken to the pleasure gardens in these fortresses. And within these pleasure gardens were topless or completely naked local women. And they would walk around this pleasure garden in a sort of haze, because they basically, with opioids and with marijuana, they would get high accidentally. It would be a passive high. They wouldn't literally be toking on a joint, but it would be put into the incense at the rituals, and they'd walk around in this sort of fug and see all these naked women, and they had to be celibate. They were all unmarried men. So suddenly you've got these young men who are seeing naked women for the first time, probably, and they are allowed to drink wine, and they might have sex with some of these women. And then they would think it was all a dream, because they'd then get knocked out either by the drugs or just pass out for other reasons.
Yeah.
From the wine, maybe. And then they'd wake up again in their beds, and they'd be told that they would have seen what they would get if they did as they were told.
Wow. It's proper indoctrination and kind of like... Although, I'd say that is what they imagined heaven would be like. They're just sort of doing a bit of... lying just to kind of prove this is where how you can get into heaven, and this is what it will be like.
It's fascinating, don't you think? Because certainly back then, today much more people are cynical about religion and atheist, agnostic, very much in Western culture. But back then, especially, you believed exactly in the tenets of your order or your sect. So to be told that you've just seen heaven. You don't have any other education to sort of... You can't dismiss it out of hand. Do you see what I mean? So they would have believed it.
And even those people who could dismiss it out of hand, they've been drugged and they've been thrown into this area which they have no experience in, presumably.
Yeah.
Wow, that's insane.
And when you have never tasted alcohol before, never come across drugs before, and never seen women naked before...
All of which is sort of outlawed... Yeah, by the tenets of their religion for mortal people.
Yeah. Wow. And so to have all three thrown at you. So they believed that if they died for the cult, then they would have this in heaven. If they did as they were told and they killed, or they would just be killed on command, then they would get this in the next life. So it's a very potent belief system.
It's a very persuasive offer. It's a great way to induct people.
Yeah, exactly.
And I assume this would be at the end of their trials once they've proven they can be an assassin. You know, this isn't the starting pitch to bring people in. It's once they've checked to see this is the sort of person we want with us. It's almost like a reward at the end of.
I think it was at the end of the trials.
Yeah.
Of it, and it's quite interesting because this devotion to the master was seen. It was actually credited to be seen by Frankish commanders who tried to besiege Masyaf, a little bit like in the game, actually, which we'll talk about later. But one man, Count Henry of Champagne, was returning from Armenia, and this was in the late 1100s. And he comes across and this old man of the mountain and at one of his castles known as Al-Kaf, which is in Syria. And Henry points out that his army is so much bigger than the master's that he should pay him an annual tribute. And this is quite a common thing to do in medieval society. If you had a big army,
yeah, and you just convince everyone to pay you unless you invade.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So he said this to this man, Sinan. And Sinan refuses and says that although the army is much larger than his own, his army is far stronger in their belief and their unwavering loyalty to him. And so he invited Henry to witness this obedience by sacrificing, I think it was two... He signals from the top of his battlements, on top of the high wall of the castle, he told one of his men to jump off, which would you couldn't live after that. You know, you were definitely going to die.
Not even if there's a bale of hay at the bottom.
Well, exactly. And they were meant to have shouted out, God is great, which I believe is Allahu Akbar. And then they would jump headlong to their death. And I think he did it twice. And that made such an impact on Henry of Champagne that he marched his armies away. And what's interesting
about... He backed off.
Yeah, backed off. And the interesting thing about that is they realised that it would spread fear. Because that's the game. If you can have such a fearful reputation, then you don't actually have to, you know, prove it every time.
Scaring people is more cost effective than beating them in battle.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And that is where the eagle dive is taken from for the games. Because the game does, I think, show that there's when they come in, except in theory you survive the jump, which is a ridiculous thought that you could survive a jump from that high. But in reality, they did commit suicide.
Yeah.
On command to prove. And from their point of view, they're about to go head to that amazing opium-induced sex party that they've been shown years earlier when
which
they joined
they
up.
They may well have. We don't know.
That's a very good point. Yeah, we're being doubtful. We don't know. We don't know any more than they did. So,
no.
Wow. I mean, that is extraordinary lengths to convince people to stay in and to scare people off. So it's all very psychological warfare. For all the, you know, stabbing they do, it's all very mind-focused and...
I think the masters of the sects were very, very intelligent men.
Yes.
And they knew how to bend minds to their will. It's a very interesting period. Because also, you've got lots of big hitters in terms of big personalities. You've got people... like Saladin, who was the head of the Ayyubids, defending the Middle East from the invading kings of Europe. So you've got Richard the Lionheart, you've got St. Louis of France, you've got Edward I, Edward Longshanks, he fought in the Holy Wars as well. So, and all these people came into contact with the Assassin's Order. So they were very much a very important part of the dynamic. Because they wouldn't take a side. So there was always... they didn't know where they would sit in the politics of it all. So everyone was scared of them.
They were this kind of third party, this boogeyman that everyone was afraid of.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, Saladin himself considered destroying this annoying little thorn in his side once and for all. And woke up one morning to find a note on his bed... through a dagger through it, literally through one of his pillows, with the note saying, "Please kindly fuck off," signed Rashid Adnan Adid Sinan.
Power move.
And but honestly, it worked. Saladin
again,
made
again,
a
that's psychological. It's not. I mean, if they just killed him, there probably would have been more problems for them. So instead, they send a message. They show how powerful they are. It's about fear. That's amazing.
Exactly.
So they really are all about scaring people away and using their position as this strange cult in the mountains to keep themselves safe, which is, you know, it's a bit crazy, but I suppose it does avoid as much bloodshed. I mean, they're not in... I mean, when you compare them to the honest, you know, honourable kings and leaders during the Crusades, who are getting thousands and thousands of people slaughtered, you have this cult, this death cult, who are actually killing a lot fewer people and having the same effect.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's sort of mind over matter. Do you go for the targeted strike, or do you just throw brute force at a problem? And there's just two very different opposing ways of getting around it, you know? Let's now look at some of the most important sort of assassinations that they committed over the years.
Okay.
The original one is very interesting, because this happened in 14th of October 1092.
Still weird hearing the saying October in 1092. I don't know why, it just sounds odd to hear a specific date that long ago.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I know what you mean.
It's nearly Halloween. I mean, you know.
I know, yeah.
In 1092, yeah.
All their outfits ready, the costumes. Well, that's actually that fits in quite well, actually, because the man who they killed was a man called Nizam al-Mulk, and he was assassinated en route to Baghdad from a place called Isfahan. And the mainstream literature tells us that he was stabbed by the dagger of a member of the assassins, and was sent by the notorious Hassan e Sabah, who was the old man of the mountain before the old man of the mountain, if you like. He was the OG. And the thing is, to make it that it's this assassination has so much description, it really paints a picture. So he was escorting his wife down to Baghdad, and he was being carried on his litter. So a bit like, you know, how they raise up the chair and they carrying them.
Super, you know, wealthy citizen. You kind of, as soon as you see that, I feel like in any game or TV show or anything, you immediately don't like that person as much.
Yeah, it's a proper sort of symbol, a status symbol.
Yes.
It? So how on earth do you get close to someone like that? Because he would have been surrounded by his retinue. He was quite an important man. And so the way they did it, the guy who, the assassin who killed him, was disguised as a dervish or holy man. So, you know, in the games where you can hide within the holy men.
And I do know that. In the games when you hide like the holy men. That is like, that's one of the early things in like the trailers of that game as well.
Yeah.
That's a big part of that game. Wow.
Exactly. Well, this might have been where they got it from, but he wouldn't have looked white and cloaked like that. He probably would have looked more, how do I put it? Like a hermit, so would have looked a bit strange.
Probably.
But holy men could walk with impunity because they were considered holy. You didn't want to upset God by, you know, you should be a rewarding. You know, if you were passing in the street, you would give them money because you wanted them to sort of give you assurance with heaven.
They had a position of authority even without being carried by in a litter. They still had this sort of.
Yeah.
This reverence around them.
But to use that sort of fiendish idea of, okay, we're going to use that one kind of person who the guards would move aside for, and I'm, you know what I mean, to get in close enough to kill him.
Yeah.
But they, as I say, they didn't just kill Muslims, they also killed Franks as well. Franks are names for Europeans back then.
Okay.
A Frank is just a European. So to go on to another kill... Raymond II of Tripoli in 1152 was assassinated, and he was a very important man. He was traveling on; he was on his way to Jerusalem, and he was escorting his wife and her sister from Tripoli to Jerusalem. So quite a long journey, and a little bit like before, they were ambushed. So it always seems to be on the road to somewhere because it's easier to get at someone if they're in a remote landscape. But this man...
Very, very unlike the games when everything's done in a city. So,
but unlike the first kill, Raymond isn't stupid. He knows that the roads are dangerous. So he has two knights who are prepared for an ambush with him. And he was, as I say, he was assassinated through an ambush by the assassins who killed him and his two knights and also the women. So they just butchered the whole party.
So would this have been a group of assassins, not just a single lone assassin? Yeah, it's like a It's a bit more of a raid on the road as opposed to a focused assassination.
Yeah, but I guess instead of it, the thing that defines them from, let's say, freedom fighters is that this was a targeted strike.
Yes,
they knew how important Raymond II of Tripoli was. I guess one of the last ones we could do is Philip de Montfort, who was the Lord of Tyre, which was one of the key cities. It was a port in right on the border with near Jerusalem. And Philip was a powerful ruler, and he was actually quite an old man at the time. This happened in the later period. It was in 17th of March 1270. And he was murdered in the street.
In the city, which is a lot more similar to the games. Wow.
Yeah.
So do we have an idea of the reasons they were targeting people, or was it just sort of leaders and their internal politics at the time?
Well, a bit like, you know, when I mentioned Henry of Champagne turns up at the door of Masyaf and says, or not Masyaf, one of the other ones, and says, give me some tribute. These other ones would have done the same thing, or there would have been a sort of existential threat from these men. And that would have been the reason why.
These are all people who had perhaps expressed interest in dealing with these assassins. Yeah. And so it's a preemptive strike. Yeah, it's a preemptive strike against these men who could be a threat to them.
Or they might have been doing it on behalf of people. So we do know that
So they may have been hired assassins as well.
Yeah. Because you've got to do... The thing about them is they're grafters. They know that they're the minnow in a big ocean. So they make the deals and they get round any way they can. And they're very, very good at it for a really long period of time when you think about it.
Mm. Yeah. Wow, that is... It's such a crazy time. It's such an interesting time in history. This huge war. I mean, the whole area is just a war zone, and unfortunately, continued to be a war zone for many years on. But it's at that time, it's just these huge nations clashing together, and they're this group who are kind of. It's sort of that third party. They can kind of be smaller than the other groups because neither side would want to annoy them so much that their opposition can gain them. Because I imagine that there'd be, you know, people. The Crusaders would probably see them as like another Islamic group, another Islamic sect. They probably wouldn't be aware that actually they are also opposing Saladin and everyone.
Well, you do wonder, don't you? You wonder how much there would have been talk about them between the different sides. You know, I mean, I imagine after being there for a while, because the thing is, it's not that the Franks just turned up and didn't talk to the locals. Because the reason they were there in the first place was for the local Christian population who were Middle Eastern. So they would have heard the stories through them, I reckon. I don't know. Maybe not. But as you say, it's a fascinating time of history because you've got Europeans, you've got the Syrian peoples, and you've got Egyptians who are involved, and then you have the Mongols as well. So it's such a melting pot of different civilizations that are clashing together, and you've just got to weather the storm.
And as something that I think we'll find in a future episode as well, it's these sorts of areas with these huge like tectonic shifts going on in the political landscape is where assassinations are primed to take place, and where groups like this, you know, we wouldn't know who they were if these huge events weren't going on. They would have been a bit more peaceful. You know, without these huge armies looking for people to fight, you don't need to attack these people. And they were fighting each other, but they could see this group in the mountains who were a threat to all of them.
Exactly. It's a really interesting... they've sort of, in the chaos, they forged this little... I wouldn't even call it kingdom, but sort of this sect, you know, just to hold off everyone else. So, yeah. Anyway, have a look at...
Well, I was just going to ask, actually, because I don't think I asked this, but do we know about a lot of their tactics and, like, what they would use to fight in? Is it like in the games where they would be lightly armoured and be using knives or... I mean, I assume they don't have hidden blades. I mean, I think that's kind of a...
The hidden blades.
Slightly anachronistic. They would have been... They're not... I mean, because the attack of Raymond of Tripoli against his two knights, but it is heavily armoured knights, perhaps against a much faster moving attackers in the sweltering heat of the Middle East. It's It's just remarkable.
They're from the area, so they know that heavy armor is just not in vogue, because the Saracens don't use heavy armor apart from very specialized units, because of the heat, and also it slows you down. And these guys are ambushers; they're hidden, you know, knives in the dark kind of attack. They're not full. They know that if they went up against a Frankish knight, they'd probably lose. You know, on an even.
But if they can attack them on the road. Yeah. And with a surprise element in slightly greater numbers, because they can't beat out the numbers, you know, in a straight-up battle. But people travelling across land with a smaller group of people. I mean, two fully decked-out knights would be pretty formidable. But against a group who are running at them, and after a day's travel in the heat,
it would be very tricky, I think. Because, as you said, they would have been rapid, they would have been fast-moving, and they would know how to kill, because... You know, they're literally, that's what they do.
And they know the terrain much better than these foreigners who are used to pleasant French rolling hills. And now they're in this desert. And these people know a lot better, this rocky mountainous desert.
Wow. And also, they attacked them on these long, long marches. So they would have been exhausted in all that gear, you know. Mm. And also, there's no one who's going to help them, because they're aliens in that environment. So they're, I would absolutely hate to have been in that sort of position. Actually, interestingly, the Templars, who obviously in the games are the antagonists of the whole game, they were set up in real life to protect pilgrims on the roads to the holy places. And this was because of, bandits, but also assassinations on the road. So they were there to escort, so that sort of thing wouldn't happen, because they would hopefully be able to defend them, or at least deter major assassinations.
So there would have probably 100% chance that there would have been assassins fighting Templars in the Holy Land at this time. As much as the game makes up, it is 100% likely that you would have an assassin in light armor, possibly wearing, you know, a cool white hood, probably not, and then fighting a Templar with a large red cross.
Well, that's
or something
definitely.
Similar.
Yeah.
So it's there's the continuation of Templars throughout history that the games push forward is perhaps a bit made up, or a lot made up, but at least at this time you would have had that. And that is, that's so strange, it's so interesting. But then there would have been, because there are other, the Templars aren't the only order of knights who are sent, or they're the only ones really there to protect pilgrims.
That's sort of their original USP, if you like. But you also had the Hospitallers, you had the Teutonic Knights, who were German, you also had the Knights of St. Thomas, which were British, you had the Knights of St. Lazarus, who were lepers, there were the Knights of Santiago, there were so many different ones, the Knights of Talavera, and there were these holy knights, all given the blessing of another holy man, the Pope, given the same instruction, although not given the same inductions to the orders.
No. Well, you know, you never know. But yes, I can see what you mean. But it's interesting. Yeah, they are almost two sides of the same coin. They are warriors ordained by their God's speaker on earth to protect them. And it's you know, the reasons behind it. The assassins are still perhaps attacking people who are threats to them, and a threat to their people, at least. They might be a slightly stranger cult, and also willing to assassinate Islamic leaders as well, but they're still protecting their people in the same way that those Order of Knights were as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's these two groups who have a very similar background, fighting and allying themselves. Although, well, I suppose that's the difference, is that the Order of Knights are allied with the crusading armies, whereas the assassins not so much with Saladin and the other.
No, but they do eventually make a truce. So I, you know, at times I just don't think that they were ever reliable allies. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
But yeah, they managed to assassinate a lot of very important people that ranged from as early as 1092 is the first time that they kind of pop up, all the way through to at least 1272. Where they actually tried to murder King Edward I of England. And that's
really?
Quite interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Edward Longshanks. Braveheart fame.
Exactly, of Braveheart fame. So this was happening in June 1272. So we're talking about the very end of the era.
right.
of assassins. And Edward I had come out on crusade and was actually being pretty effective and was gaining land, gaining ground against the Muslims. And whilst he retook the crusader city of Acre, which comes up in the games. And whilst he was there, they're asleep in bed. And this seems to be a bit of a trend. They like to attack, obviously, at night makes most sense because everyone's tired, who's on duty, and obviously the target is completely unsuspecting.
I played the games. Moving. It's a lot easier to sneak around at night, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. So this spy had managed to sneak into the room I'm going to take it straight from the source here. So this is according to the account made by a man called the Templar of Tyre. And this is what happened next. So he's crept in. The Saracen met him and stabbed him on the hip with a dagger, making a deep, dangerous wound. The Lord Edward felt himself struck, and he struck the Saracen a blow with his fist on the temple, which knocked him senseless to the ground for a moment. Then the Lord Edward caught up a dagger from the table, which was in the chamber, and stabbed the Saracen in the head and killed him.
My God, what a reversal. That's amazing.
I know. Can you imagine? King Edward's in bed, probably not wearing that much, you know, definitely no armor or anything. His wife sleeping next to him. This assassin, for some reason, he must have been disturbed or something by movement or something. Like, he stabs him in the hip, which is such a strange place to stab. Mm. And then Edward gets up in his nightclothes, smashes the guy in the head, picks up a knife and ends the assassin's life.
God, what a... Yeah, I mean, that is... I mean, I can only imagine that also it is an account from a Templar and a Christian. So maybe not 100% accurate, but still, I mean, we know that he survived. Because then he goes back and fights Mel Gibson. So yeah, exactly. we know he's okay. But that is an extraordinary tale. Oh wow!
I know.
And this is in the Holy Land. This is while he's out on crusade. Yeah.
Yeah, in Acre. And the thing is about it is it actually shows also that it's the waning of the power of these assassins. Mm,
this is the end.
They didn't kill. And this wasn't meant to send a message. This was meant to be a death. This was an assigned assassination.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, they didn't try to go for the same thing as they did with Saladin. By putting a knife next to his bed. Maybe that's what he was trying to do and accidentally hit his hip. He was trying to like leave it in the bed as a cool thing and he accidentally hit the king. Because, yeah, you're right. Why would you go for the hip or the... It's not a very good assassin, I believe, here, so...
No, it's not, is it? It's not. So let's move on now to the next part. So I'd say the most interesting end to this story is the Mongols, who people probably don't associate with the Crusades, actually make an appearance towards the end of this period, so in the 1250s onwards, where they have crushed Persia to the east of the Middle East, if you like. Yes. And then they start encroaching on the Middle East, onto the Holy Land, where there's a fight going on between the Crusaders of Europe and the Ayyubids of the area. So there's suddenly a third faction who's come into the mix. But the Mongols realize quite quickly that they don't like this assassin sect just sitting up in the mountains. And unlike... I'm not trying to sort of... be too horrible to either the Ayyubids or the Franks, but they just didn't care enough to go up and kill them. Or maybe they were so scared by all the murders.
The fear tactics had worked. I mean, they certainly tried hard to scare both sides, so...
Yeah.
But and the Mongols... It's harder to scare the Mongols.
This is the thing. The Mongols couldn't give two shits. They just see them as a threat, and so they sent 10,000 men, which is one-fifth of the entire army that they'd come to the area with, to go up and crush the sect up in the mountains. This started in 1253 and lasted 3 years. It was a 3-year campaign just against this tiny little sect up in the mountains.
I mean, they are well fortified and it's mountainous terrain, good defenses, high walls. You could last forever against an army.
So the reason why they launched this campaign was actually from a provocation from the assassins.
Assassins, bad leadership, bad tactics now.
I know. Well, no, to be fair to the assassins, the first thing the assassins do when the Mongols turn up is they send a delegation to Karakorum, which is where the was the Mongol capital at the time, to ask to pay homage to the Khan. And the Khan just basically wasn't impressed, hadn't heard of them, and told them to get lost, basically.
Wow. Which is unlike how they've reacted to any of the other leaders around them.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, this is coming towards the end of their power, so they're probably looking to make alliances more than they're looking to... You know, the fear factor isn't going to help. They notice that in the Mongols. Mm. Anyway, so they're dismissed, and this is obviously quite a rude tactic by the Mongols, but not surprised, it's the Mongols. But so then what they do is apparently, and we get this from an eyewitness source called William of Rubruck, who was in Karakorum in 1253, 40 assassins tried to kill the Khan, Monke Khan, at the capital in his palace. Yeah.
40 now, assassins.
Yeah, 40 assassins were sent, and the security was stepped up massively, and I don't think they even got close. But they were that, what's the word, arrogant? Or self-assured that they thought they could take out the Khan of... I mean, that is so
I mean, say, you say self-assured. They'd got within striking distance to the King of England and the leader and Saladin. It doesn't seem like that. I mean, it feels like... And with 40 of them...
But the thing is, those two places are quite small. The Khan ruled China, Mongolia, most of Persia. We're talking about
good point.
This
yeah.
is like taking out the biggest player on Earth at the time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, this is sort of so fascinating. So, as a result, this 10,000-strong force, we're pretty sure they were Tajik, which is from Tajikistan. The Tajiks were the ones assigned to do this. And they lost... lots of men in the process, but they eventually managed to burn out most of the fortresses, including Masyaf. And as a result, the rest of them spread all across, the rest of the assassins spread across the kingdoms. They dispersed, and they never really regained their power ever again.
Wow!
But they did survive. They still go today. So as I say,
they're still going today. But as a sect of Islam, as opposed to a group of assassins.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they would always say that they were a sect of Islam. It's just that they didn't. they were slightly more bloodthirsty than
we're just looking at them from the assassin point of view.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that is
extraordinary. Cool. So all their clever tactics, all their fear tactics, all their death cult and their assassin abilities comes up short against the largest. Is it like the largest continuous empire? I think.
It is, yeah.
Not in history, yeah, yeah.
In history, yeah.
Yeah, so...
And fair enough.
Which fair enough, yeah. If you're going to go out, I mean, if you're going to lose to someone, the Mongols are, you know, no one's going to look down on you for losing to the Mongols, so...
No, exactly. And they, you know, they held their own for over 100 years against the Ayyubids and the crusading forces as well. So pretty good effort, I think, overall.
That is extraordinary, yeah. So, shall we now move on to talking a bit about what the game's got right and wrong?
Yeah, so the game came out in 2007, I think. So I think it's just a fantastic game. And I think
we're both huge fans. I know that a lot of people have issues with it, of it being repetitive and stuff. And this isn't... We're not going to devolve into a gaming podcast, although I think we both could talk about games for just as long as we could about history. But yeah, we wanted to take a look and see what was different about it and what they got right and what they got wrong. And, you know, they're not too bad, I think. They certainly get the broad strokes right, and they haven't completely made everything up. They've maybe skirted around the truth a bit, but, you know, they are game developers. They're not really, this isn't a piece of historical writing.
No, it's not like a documentary. But having said that, I think whoever did the history research on this did a pretty good job. I mean, honestly, most of the things that you play in the game did happen. So the places like Acre exist, obviously Jerusalem and Damascus, they were all they were real places, obviously, and they were held at the right time in 1191 when the game is set. And they had Saladin in the game, and they have Richard the Lionheart in the game, who were both there. So I think that's a pretty good start.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it'd be strange if they got a lot of that wrong and they just made up parts of history. But it's nice. I think that's what we both actually found really interesting about the game, is I did feel like I learnt a lot about the Crusades and the world that it, because you can sometimes learn it a bit from a Western point of view, and you just learn about the Western kings who went over. You don't really learn about anyone on the other side. And although this game doesn't dive too much into that, it certainly kind of shows them both moderately equally. I mean, you spend as much time, if not more time, in Islamic cities as you do. Yeah, there's two Islamic cities and only one Christian city. So
yeah,
it's a very interesting game.
I do like how at the beginning it says this game, they have to put the proviso out that this game was made by people with multiple different faiths, and so they're not like attacking either, because it's a very contentious topic, especially in like the early noughties when you've had, you know, I mean, in 2007 you've got the Afghanistan war going on, the Iraq war I think is still going on just about, mm-hmm. or might have just ended, and you know, it's post 9/11, so to be talking about this stuff, and it's essentially a terrorist organization.
It is an extraordinary thing that you are playing a. And although we both complain about the fact that the main character, the main protagonist, is given an American accent, which is a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know indeed. But, I mean, he is ignoring that. And perhaps this is why they gave it to him, because if they gave him a proper accent, it would have been very clear that this is one of the first protagonists in a video game where the protagonist is Islamic. Because there's no doubt that they would have been Islamic. They don't really lean into it in the games, but they are a sect of Islam who are attacking Christians and killing Christians. And so it is remarkable that this game didn't come under fire, and perhaps it was because they gave the main character an American accent, so you sort of saw him as American, even though he is definitely not. Altair is the furthest from a American name. And then that is also perhaps why they added the slightly stranger animus. It's all set in present day, looking back at history, and actually you're actually playing Desmond, who is an American, and so you can kind of skirt around the edges.
That's what I always thought when I was playing it. I kind of thought I discounted the American accent because I always thought that Desmond Miles was just Altair, so I was just like, oh, it's obviously in his brain he thinks he would have sounded American
because I mean, they're all speaking English, they're not speaking they're not speaking the actual language they should be speaking, and I think they probably explain that away in the game. So, but if they had leaned into it, as I think a lot of people, I think we would have liked at the time, if they just set it in that time period, they gave them proper accents, it may have been a bit too controversial and actually would have come under fire. And that's perhaps why they've kept it. And actually, it kind of gives them a free pass, because you're always viewing it as history. You're not playing history. You are just viewing it from a modern day. Look, albeit through a weird science, looking back at your ancestors' DNA or whatever they explain it as.
Is your physics brain going, no, can't do that?
I mean, I'm sure there's probably biologists who absolutely hate that game, and the description it gives of, you know, you have you have all your ancestors' memories in your DNA, which...
God, if that was true.
It'd be very cool if it was true, but I also think it would be a lot boring for most of us, because most of us, you know, it's like there's the people who predict, who, you know, they tell you who was in your history, and somehow everyone was related to George Washington or something like that, or Elizabeth the First. You know, it's remarkable that we all are, but they get quite a lot right. Do they get many of the targets right?
So yes, they do. So of the nine victims, as you're sent out to kill nine of them. Five of them actually did exist, and a sixth one was based on someone who did. So that's pretty good going.
It's pretty good. They did take from history, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, let's just start with the ones they got wrong. So the three who were entirely fictitious were all, unfortunately, the sort of local Middle Eastern targets. It's a Western-made game, so fair enough, they got that wrong. But the three that they got wrong was the first target was an arms dealer, and his name was just simply Tamir. So they didn't even bother.
No full name. No.
So why not make that Nizam al-Mulk? You could have made it, you know, so easily. The guy on the litter from earlier.
It is interesting that they choose not to take actual assassinations from their history. But
I think that's probably my biggest problem with the game. But I mean, that's such an... That's just me being a historian. You know what I mean? the other two were Talal, again, just a random slaver chief. And the final one was Abul Nukod, who I've definitely slaughtered that name, who was the fat merchant guy who tries to poison everyone.
Right.
So those three were completely made up. But apart from that, all the rest of them had some form of history around them. But as far as I can tell, not a single one was assassinated. So they chose people who would have been there in 1191, but actually they didn't bother to... there was only so far they would have taken the research, you know?
I mean, there could have been a chance they didn't want to get it wrong. And so if they actively choose targets who weren't killed, then they can't be proved wrong and say, oh, actually, you did this wrong. It's like, well, we've completely made this up. You know, if you deviate far enough, you get less people, although not everyone, because we've made a podcast about it. But
oh, yeah. What, like 13 years after it was released as well?
Yes, I'm sure this is hard-hitting journalism right here.
I'm sure they're going to be listening to this and going, damn it, I wish we just made it slightly better.
Oh, we didn't know about this guy, yeah.
So the ones they got right, the ones that sort of stand out, I think, are Garnier de Nablus, who in the game I think is Garnier de Naplus. I think they just turn it to a P for some reason. But he was the demonic surgeon in Acre who's sort of like cutting off body parts in the hospital.
Yes, I remember. Yeah.
He was horrible, but he did exist. And he was, as far as I know, he was the Grand Master of the Hospitaller Order at the time. But he wasn't assassinated. He fought at the Battle of Arcerf, which is the last battle in the game, and he died of his wounds there. So he was around, but he didn't die from Altair's blade.
Well, that we know of, you know. You never know.
Maybe he was on the battlefield, yeah.
I mean, in the game, Altair is at the Battle of Arcerf, so you don't know how.
He is. Actually, that's
what I mean, Altair also isn't real, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But Robert de Sable, the main bad guy, he was the Grand Master of the Knights Templar.
Yes.
Like he is in the games. And did die near Arcerf, which in the game you assassinate him in Arcerf at the battle. But he died 2 years after the battle, but he was, you know, that was pretty close getting it right.
It's not too far off, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So they can get some names right.
And they got Masyaf right, and they got Eagle Vision right. No, I'm only joking.
they really could see through walls, yeah.
Yeah. And they got the Eagle Dive right at the beginning.
Ish, half right. They got the beginning of it right. Yep, they ended it they got the ending wrong, yeah.
It would have been a very short game if in the first...
It would have been a very short game, yeah.
You just fall to your death, and that's the end.
Yes.
The other names on the list, William of Montferrat, he did exist.
This one's so annoying, though, because they actually do, in real life, they do kill a Montferrat, but a different Montferrat, which is so strange, because they kill Conrad of Montferrat.
Yeah, Conrad.
Which is remarkable that they just, I mean, maybe they just decided to switch the name. Perhaps Conrad isn't the most interesting name and actually... They wanted to find a bit more of a... William, that sounds a bit more like a noble crusader from Western Europe, whereas Conrad, it's not quite as strong a name. Apologies for anyone called Conrad, but it's so strange they just decided, let's switch it over, because presumably they may have been... Well, it's of Montferrat, so neighbours, I guess?
I'm pretty sure they're related.
Oh, really?
Family. Yeah.
So it's strange that they decided to go for a slightly different Montferrat, but they could have gone for the one they actually assassinated.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. It's a very strange one. Another one they got right was Jubair al-Hakim, who was one of the major scholars on the Third Crusade, but he didn't die in the time period. He died in 1217 in Alexandria in Egypt, having written up everything. He was best mates with Saladin, so he accompanied Saladin on all of his conquests. For me, I'd give it a solid 8.5 out of 10 on accuracy, which is pretty good for a game.
Which is almost as much as they need. If they try to get it to a 10, I think it would either take them too long or they might suck a bit of the fun out of the game, because they'd have to, you know, you're supposed to be, as you're taking on the targets, it's supposed to be building intention. If, you know, they go out of order, and some of them as a group, you just run onto the road and stab a knight and then run off. It's, you know, it's not quite as dramatic.
It isn't, is it? And also, you've got to imagine maybe that the historian who did all this work for them presented it all to Ubisoft, and Ubisoft went, yeah, we like this bit and we like that bit, but I'm not really sure. And they could probably just cut and pasted like bits of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I
yeah. And I think, I think this is what we've looked at is a testament to the historians at Ubisoft or whoever they hired to do it, that they did a bloody good job, and they that maybe did. Ubisoft just decided to cut out bits and pieces. They thought, yeah, we don't need that. Conrad? No, that's not a bad guy named. William de Montfort. There we go.
Oh, yeah.
There it is. Yeah, yeah. And we can't have the Grand Master, the main enemy, die off screen a few years later. No, he's got to die in a battle at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
really good. Well,
so that concludes our first episode of the Cloak and Dagger podcast.
It does. Oh, this is very exciting. Well, we hope you liked it, and we're going to be doing more. We're going to be going back and forth between us. So next week is my week, and we will be journeying kind of across the world to ancient India, to a very different time and a very different place. But still cool assassin-y things. Although it's a bit more myths and legends, this one, as opposed to hard facts. But hopefully it's just as interesting as this one was.
Great. Looking forward to it. And guys, if you want to follow us, we are on Instagram at Cloak and Dagger Podcast, all one word. And you can also leave a review on whatever podcatcher that you have.
Wherever you're listening to us.
Yeah. And please tell a friend. It really helps make the podcast spread, doesn't it?
Yeah, tell people, anyone else you know who really likes history or assassins or video games or just listening to two guys argue about stuff. But yeah, thank you very much. I think this has been really fun.
It has, and tune in next time. Thank you.
Tune in next time. Okay, I'll stop the recording.